humid air mass to the area. Meanwhile, a low pressure system moving across the plains will bring scattered showers and thunderstorms to Iowa and Missouri by this afternoon. This activity is expected to move eastward and arrive in Illinois later today. Highs today will range from the mid-70s in southern Wisconsin to the low 90s in southeastern Missouri. Lows tonight will range from near 60 in central Indiana to the low 70s in southern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, partly sunny with a high of 83. The wind from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, there's a chance of showers and thunderstorms. This evening, showers and thunderstorms are likely after midnight. The low, 65. The wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms are likely. Look for a high around 80. The wind out of the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of evening showers. The low, 65. The wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Sunday, partly sunny with a high in the upper 70s. The wind out of the north at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Sunday night, partly cloudy with a low around 60. Monday and Monday night, mostly clear with a high Monday around 80 and a low Monday night around 60. And let's go out a little further here. The Weather Service says for Tuesday through Thursday of next week in East Central Illinois, partly cloudy with highs in the mid-80s and lows in the mid-60s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-70s to the mid-80s. It was cloudy in northern and western Illinois. Elsewhere, sunshine was reported. Rockford reported 75 degrees at the top of the hour. It was 78 at O'Hare, 81 in Bloomington. Mattoon checked in with 79. Carbondale, 84. South Bend, 78 degrees. Lafayette, 81. Indianapolis, 79 degrees. And it was 80 in Terre Haute. Willard Airport reported a sunny sky at the top of the hour, 80 degrees. The dew point, 58. The relative humidity, 46%. The wind, light and variable. And the barometric pressure, 30.04 and falling. And at 12:39, 83 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Time now for another installment in the Chicago Public Radio radio science experiment, Clever Apes. We're wired to experience the world in three dimensions, four if you count time, but physics predicts more dimensions out there, or maybe fewer. Gabriel Spitzer brings us the stories of two researchers, one measuring the shape of music and another hunting for signs that the world is flat.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Clever Apes. One of the central pillars of science is testability. You don't just get to have a crazy idea, you have to be able to do an experiment that shows over and over that it's true. But in recent decades, physicists exploring the fundamental nature of the universe crossed a threshold. String theory, quantum loop cosmology, multiverses, some of these really mind-bending ideas are so remote, there's almost no way to verify them except through math. Count this one in that camp, too.
Everybody's seen holograms, like in your credit card or in a museum. You see a film, a two-dimensional sheet, but if you look into it, you see this apparent virtual three-dimensional world in there. But, you know, if you lived inside it, it might not be obvious to you that you also fit on the surface of a credit card. Well, it could be that the actual world is like that.
Now, Craig Hogan swears the idea that we live in a hologram is not that weird.
It's actually, in a way, more intuitive than a lot of the physics that we're used to.
Right. Hogan directs the Particle Astrophysics Center at Fermilab and teaches at the University of Chicago. The theory he's working with is that what we see in front of us isn't really here. It's actually happening at the edge of space, and it's playing out like a film on the wall of the universe. He didn't just pull this from thin air. It comes out of well-established physics. But how do you test an idea like that? A lot of people say you can't. Craig Hogan thinks maybe he can.
If we do live in a hologram, like your hologram and your credit card, it's a little bit blurry. So if reality is like that, then we should expect a little bit of blurriness in the virtual image that is reality. And that's something we might observe.
In this theory, space and time aren't smooth. They're pixelated, like a low-res photo or a pointillist painting. The pixels are way too small to ever see. But Hogan is building a machine that can get pretty close.
You can detect motions of an atometer, which is a billionth of a billionth of a meter. It's as much smaller than an atom as an atom is smaller than a human.
The pixels are probably still 100 million billion times smaller than that. Hogan's machine may be sensitive enough to at least see an effect, a jitter in space-time.
So we're standing in a tunnel at Fermilab, and it's been converted into a laser lab.
The contraption Hogan's team is fashioning here is called the holometer. This is a prototype.
So this is a laser table. It's the optical bench, which is sort of the business end. The laser is that box there at the end.
You have to wear goggles in here because the beam can zap your retina in an instant. Fermilab scientist Chris Stoughton fires it up.
Okay, laser's on. You should see some beam coming out here.
Two beams travel at a right angle and bounce back. If space is pixelated, they should jump around a little bit. And if Hogan's calculations are correct, finding jitters would mean we're moving through a fuzzy projection off that great film strip in the sky. If you're thinking this hologram idea sounds ridiculous, you're not alone. But in the past few years, it's basically gone mainstream in theoretical physics. Leonard Susskind of Stanford University is one of the originators of the holographic principle.
I think it's pretty much an accepted principle of physics. How it will be used is not known. But I don't think there's any real disagreement that the holographic principle is a consequence, a mathematical consequence of quantum mechanics plus gravity.
But what is in dispute is whether a setup like Hogan's will actually prove what it's out to prove. Like string theory, which Susskind basically invented, he says the holographic principle may be impossible to prove, undeniable in the math, but unknowable in the lab.
We will never directly, experimentally verify this. Well, I should never say never. But in order to do experiments which are sensitive to this, you would have to build an accelerator as big as the galaxy. This is not within the range of any kind of technology that we're likely to see.
And yet, what if it works? Even a glimpse of what Hogan is looking for would shake up a picture of the universe that's held sway since Einstein. Jason Steffen is another astrophysicist on Hogan's project.
That would be a chink in the armor of general relativity. General relativity has withstood all experimental tests of it. And it's also 100 years old.
Dr. Hogan, are you trying to take down Einstein?
That's a pretty strong way of putting it. I mean, no, you go beyond it. What we're trying to do is to create a synthesis which ties together what Einstein did and quantum physics.
It's all part of this dance between theory and experiments. We don't get new science without someone thinking of crazy ideas. We don't weed out the fantasy from the reality without real tests. Even if the really deep truths about the universe are beyond the reach of experiments, Craig Hogan believes we won't know until we try. We don't usually think of music as having dimensions. At best, maybe the two dimensions of notes plotted on a staff. But Dmitri Tomasko of Princeton can show you three or four dimensions. Music, he says, is mathematical, and that means it has a definite shape.
Well, we've always known that there are connections between music and math going back to Pythagoras 2,500 years ago. But in the last couple decades, it's become clear that there's a very intense connection between music and geometry. What's interesting is that musical knowledge is traditionally been a kind of embodied physical knowledge. What composers do is they sit at their instrument, usually a piano, and they build up a kind of physical knowledge of the space of musical possibilities. What we've come to realize is that there's an alternative and equivalent way of representing this embodied knowledge, and that is through geometry. The intuitive knowledge that we used to have a very hard time describing can be redescribed as a knowledge of how to move around in these very complex, often higher dimensional geometrical spaces. You can picture a sort of grid or a lattice of cubes connected to each other. And what a lot of musicians like to do is move by short distances in this space, exploiting paths between points, which represent chords, that are near one another. I think the most beautiful example comes from Chopin and the E minor prelude. And this is a very mysterious, liquid, almost melting piece. Composers and theorists have had a very hard time understanding exactly how it works. And it turns out that in this piece, what Chopin is doing is taking very small steps through a kind of twisted four-dimensional donut that represents all the four-note chords you can play on a piano. What's remarkable is when you plot the music in this geometrical space, its structure immediately becomes crystal clear. So what I like to say is that we're very good at reading maps or seeing visual relationships. Our brains are not optimized for hearing musical structure, and so what's great about this translation into geometrical form is that it allows us to bring to bear our extraordinary pattern-matching capabilities on the project of understanding music. What we have here is, for the first time, a really principled way of translating back and forth between the domain of music and the domain of space. So it's not a metaphor, and it's not something arbitrary, and that's made possible by the fact that they are mathematically very similar.
Dmitri Tomasko is a music theorist and composer at Princeton. His new book is A Geometry of Music. That's it for this dose of Clever Apes. With thanks to producer Michael DeBonis, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We'll be back with more Clever Apes.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine tastings on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. This Saturday, it's a tasting of new arrivals from France, followed by live music from 7 to 9 by DJ Westchild. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 12th of August, 2011. It's the birthday of the woman who wrote the lines, "O beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties above the fruited plain." Catherine Lee Bates, born in Falmouth, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, 1859. She went to Wellesley College, became an English professor there. Summer of 1893, she was teaching at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. And it was there she took a trip to Pikes Peak, rode a wagon most of the way up,